Maggie O'Farrell was born on the 27th of May 1972. She is a novelist from Northern Ireland. Her first novel was After You've Gone and won the Betty Trask Award, and a later one, The Hand That Held Me First, won the 2010 Costa Novel Award. She has twice been shortlisted since the Costa Novel Award for The Instructions for a Heatwave in 2014, This Must Be the Place I'm In in 2017. She appeared in the Waterstones 25 Authors for the Future, and her memoir, I Am, I Am, I Am, 17 Brushes with Death, reached the top of the Sunday Times bestseller list. Her novel Hamnet won the Women's Prize for Fiction in 2020 and the Fiction Prize for the 2020 National Book Critics Circle Awards. The Marriage Portrait was shortlisted for the 2023 Women's Prize for Fiction as well. The extracts you will hear from the audiobook are read by our very own volunteer reader, Claire Millens. Unfortunately, the book publishers would not let us use the original audio. Apologies for this, but this is something that's out of our control. However, I think you'll agree, Claire does a fantastic job. This morning I have Debbie Heath in the studio with me. Welcome, Debbie.
Thank you for having me back.
Welcome back indeed. So I have to thank you again for suggesting this book. Hamnet was wonderful and probably, I think, my favourite of all the book reviews we've done so far.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. And any listeners out there who are going to listen to this book, I would suggest you listen to it with a hanky or a box of tissues nearby, because it's quite a heartbreaking story.
It is.
It's not to say it's completely sad and there's light and dark in it, but I found it quite hard going. How did you feel about it?
Yes, it is an emotional read, but I found it very easy to read. It's written in a very accessible way. And I have read another of Maggie O'Farrell's books. I hadn't been bowled over, actually, but I thought this was really, really good. I didn't love it, possibly as much as you did, but I genuinely liked it and will be recommending it to lots of people and to our lovely listeners. And we should explain why it is worth listening to.
Absolutely, yes. It is. It's a story based in the 15th century, and I don't think there's any surprise or any plot spoilers to say that it is based around the life of Will Shakespeare and his wife, Agnes Hathaway, as she is called. And it tells the tale of their son, Hamnet. He's a twin to Judith, and they have another daughter,
Suzanne,
thank you. And it tells a tale, and it begins with Hamnet trying to find his mum. His sister has fallen ill. She's taken to her bed, and Hamlet's trying to find an adult to help.
Yeah, an adult, because they lived with their grandparents. I think they describe it as being a house that's always full of noise, and at a time when he actually needs those interfering adults, there is no one there.
Yeah.
I found that very, very touching opening, so desperate to protect his twin. I mean, that's another interesting theme, actually.
Yes.
Twins. Shakespeare used twins a lot in his plays.
Yes.
In different ways.
Exactly. And the interchange of the twins play a trick, don't they?
Yes, they do.
They pretend to be each other at various points, and it's become one of their childhood tricks that they do. One pretends to be the other. And that becomes quite a poignant theme.
Yes, there is a sad twist to this later on in the book. It's fascinating.
So maybe we should chat about the characters of Agnes and her husband, who's always referred to as the husband,
yes,
or the tutor, or the son. He is never named
William.
No.
Never.
No. Throughout the whole book, he is the unnamed character. Yeah.
So. Absolutely. It's a feminist novel, really.
I'm glad you said that, because I thought so too.
Yes. Yes. I mean, he is just not terribly important. The book is really about his absence.
It is.
Isn't it? As a husband, as a father, which I find really refreshing. So we go from not knowing very much about Shakespeare's wife to, in this book, not knowing very much about Agnes's husband, which is lovely. As it started, it explained about her own childhood, didn't it?
It did.
Which I didn't enjoy that section as much. I found it a little bit hard going for the beginning of the book, but it was actually very necessary because it helped us to understand some of her odd choices, such as giving birth in a wood,
yes,
rather than with the help of a midwife. And when she tries the second time to give birth in a wood, you're actually really willing her on to go and do something which is actually very irresponsible, but she doesn't know that she's having twins.
It's very clever, isn't it? Because we first meet her, she's running through a wood and she's got a kestrel on her arm, and they think she's a boy at first. I mean, she looks like a man running through a wood, but until the husband or the husband-to-be at that stage looks further and isn't quite intrigued by her. And she's called a waif and a fairy and a witch and all various things, isn't she? Because she's very in touch with nature. In fact, I mean, you know, Agnes can feel when people are not well or feel attitudes around people, which is quite fascinating in itself. And as you say, I think the book is essentially about her. So let's listen to an extract from the audiobook describing how Agnes is viewed by her fellow villagers.
She has a certain notoriety in these parts. It is said that she is strange, touched, peculiar, perhaps mad. He has heard that she wanders the back roads and forest at will, unaccompanied, collecting plants to make dubious potions. It is not wise to cross her, for people say she learnt her crafts from an old crone who used to make medicines and spin, and could kill a baby with a single glance. It is said that the stepmother lives in terror of the girl putting hexes on her, especially now the yeoman is dead. Her father must have loved her, though, because he left her a sizeable dowry in his will. Not that anyone, of course, would want to wed her. She is said to be too wild for any man. Her mother, God rest her soul, had been a gypsy, or a sorceress, or a forest sprite. The tutor has heard many of these fanciful tales about her. His own mother shakes her head and tuts when this girl comes up in conversation.
There's an interesting passage in the book. We were talking about bubonic plague and that both of the twins managed to catch bubonic plague. And there's a wonderful passage, and I think it's chapter 11, where O'Farrell describes how a flea, and it's in such great detail. And
yeah,
it's such
you don't realise that's what it is to start with, do you?
Yes.
It starts off talking about a Manx sailing boy, cabin boy, who meets a monkey, and you think, oh, right, she's gone completely off on a tangent here. This is going to be a really important character. And, I mean, in a way, it is.
Yes, very important, yeah.
Because of what happens next. And he meets the monkey. The monkey has fleas. The fleas jump onto him. They then jump onto the cats on the ship. And it's a little self-contained story. Mm. But it's marvellous. These are really incidental, minor characters, although the actions of these characters have a catastrophic effect on the main characters. And what O'Farrell does here so exquisitely is builds up these minor characters into a little story in its own right. And it's brilliant. She does a similar thing later when she talks about the passage of a letter getting between the family and the husband. Yeah, it's just so well drawn. You can visualise it, can't you?
Yes, absolutely. I was like you. When I started reading that passage, I thought,
what?
This is odd. This is very odd. I could listen to it and I was thinking, where is this going? And then it started to fall in place. And these minute actions of these, as you say, minor characters really, really put it home. Because this is what happens. This is how the bubonic plague gets into the country. And I think it's especially sort of poignant with us having gone through COVID.
The COVID, absolutely, yes, I thought the same thing.
I mean, this is the 15th century and essentially the same thing happened to us not 2 years ago. Let's have an extract from chapter 11 where we can trace the journey of the flea.
One of these fleas falls unseen to the ground, where the boy will unwittingly crush it with the sole of his foot. The second stays for a while in the sandy hair of the boy, making its way to the front of his crown. When he is paying for a flagon of the local brew in the tavern, it will make a leap, an agile, arching spring, from the forehead to the shoulder of the innkeeper. The third of the monkey's fleas will remain where it fell, in the fold of the red cloth tied around the boy's neck, given to him by his sweetheart at home. Later, when the boy has returned to the ship for the night, Having eaten a dinner of some of the spiced nuts and a curious patty of bread shaped like a pancake, he will pick up his favourite of the ship's cats, an animal mostly white, but with a striped tail, and nuzzle it against his neck. The flea, alert to the presence of a new host, will transfer itself from the boy's neckerchief to the thick, milk-white fur of the cat's neck. This cat, feeling unwell, and with the feline's unerring eye for those who dislike it, will take up residence the next day in the hammock of the midshipman. When he, that night, comes to his hammock, he will curse at the now dead animal he finds there, turn it unceremoniously out, kicking it across the room. Four or five fleas, one of which once belonged to the monkey, will remain where the cat lay. The monkey's flea is a clever one, intent on its survival and success in the world.
What did you think of the language? It's very sensual, this book, isn't it? There's lots of description of smells and
yes. And I really like that. I'm a very sensory person, and I suppose having lost sight, smells, I've got a really good sense of smell. And I actually get very distracted by smells. Mm. So I really liked that emphasis in the book.
Yeah. Anya's kind of seems to use her kind of sense of smell for so many things.
Mm.
And there's a bit where she suspects the husband of having an affair. And I think
she can smell it, can't she?
She can smell it. And she has a bracelet he's bought her. And she suddenly takes it off because there's a smell coming off it. And it smells, I think it's mould or damp or something. Mm.
But I think all this, the smell thing, it's a real nature lover's book. It's an animal lover's book.
Yes.
And it's all part and parcel of that. There's a beautiful piece of imagery. What was it? Kittens with faces like pansies. And I thought, yes, absolutely. A long-haired kitten's face is like a pansy.
Yes.
I'd never thought about that before.
No.
So she's got a lovely command of the English language, hasn't she?
Yes, you're right. There are lots of references to animals, to flowers, to trees, and it's very sensual and very rich in that sense. And she captures that so well. And if you do have a good sense of smell, and I've got a reasonable one, I was smelling things and thinking, okay, I get it. Let's listen to the audiobook for a great example of this.
The bracelet, she realises, has something bad coming off it, like steam. It was too cold at first, gripping her skin with an icy, indifferent embrace. Now, though, it is too hot, too tight. Its single red eye glowers up at her with baleful intent. Someone unhappy, she knows, has worn it. Someone who dislikes her or resents her. It is steeped in bad luck, bad feeling, polished with it to a dull lustre. Whoever it used to belong to wishes her harm. Eliza sits, smiling now as she finishes speaking. Agnes looks at her husband, and suddenly she sees it, feels it, scents it. All over his body, all over his skin, his hair, his face, his hands, as if an animal has run over him again and again, leaving tiny paw marks. He is, Agnes realises, covered in the touches of other women. She looks down at her plate, at her own hands, her own fingers, at their roughened tips, at the walls and loops of her fingerprints, at the knuckles and scars and veins of them. At the nails she cannot stop herself gnawing the minute they emerge. For a moment, she believes she may vomit. Grasping the bracelet, she draws it off her wrist. She looks at the ruby, holds it close to her face, wondering what it has seen, where it has come from, how it came into her husband's possession. It is a deep, interior red, a drop of frozen blood. She raises her eyes, and her husband is looking straight at her. She puts the bracelet down on the table, holding his gaze. For a moment, he seems confused. He glances at the bracelet, then at her, then back. He half rises, as if he might speak. Then the blood rushes to his face. his neck. He lifts a hand, as if to reach out for her, then lets it drop. She stands, without speaking, and leaves the room.
So, our three reasons for suggesting or recommending this audiobook.
Historically, it's interesting, isn't it? Mm. It takes a historical figure and looks at him from a completely different viewpoint. And yes. I think that's really interesting. And it's enlightening, it's refreshing. I think that would be my first reason.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right and true, because so much has been written about Shakespeare and his language and his plays, and, you know, he's one of our finest literary figures ever. But he's a second fiddle in this. So, you're absolutely right. It's a really interesting way of talking about that era and that specific time. Second one?
Well, I think we've touched on her use of language. She's such a good wordsmith all the way through, for the reasons we've discussed, the imagery involving your senses, the way she creates her characters, minor and major. She really is a master of her craft.
I would agree with that. Can I steal that as one of mine as
well? Yes, certainly you can.
So, yeah, no, absolutely. And your third?
I don't want to put male readers off, but it is a really interesting piece of feminist literature. Mm. I don't think it can only be fully appreciated by women, don't get me wrong, but I think it might resonate with women more. But I think everyone who has some interest in that period of history in Shakespeare, or has gone through child loss and is feeling strong enough to listen to that, or has an interest in the supernatural, animals, nature, it appeals actually to such a wide range of people.
Yeah.
But yeah, the feminist slant resonated well with me.
I think my three, I would agree with language, and as I said, it's sensual and it's quite visceral, and you can get a really good sense of everything through the language, and it's well written. The kind of jumping between passages of time worked very, very well. I think I said it while we were chatting. I think it's a timeless sort of portrait of loss and grief, and it could happen at any time. I like the fact that it needn't to be set in the 15th century. It could be set in the future. It still resonates.
But she's done that because it's given us an extra, a different view on something we thought we knew, and I really respect that.
A different dimension to it.
Made life a bit harder for herself.
Yes. And I think it's got real emotional intelligence, and it's sad without being sentimental. And
yes, you're right. It's not mawkish in any way.
No. And it's not. And if I put people off by saying get a hanky or a box of tissues, I meant that in the best possible way, because it is an uplifting book. I think it is sad, but then there are passages of joy as well.
So yes, absolutely.
I think for that reason, to manage to do that without being sentimental or mawkish or morbid is a real, real skill. So,
yeah, agreed.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Debbie.
Oh, thank you.
Huge thanks to Debbie Heath there. Just as a reminder, Calibre Audio offer completely free access to a wide range of audiobooks, including Hamnet. For further info, you can get in touch by phoning 01296 432 339 or emailing inquiries@calibre.org.uk.